Simple. 10-01s. Good morning, everyone. The County Board of County Commissioners meeting will now come to order. If anyone has any cell phones or any other audible devices, if you silence them now, is not to disrupt the rest of the meeting. And Brett, while you're standing in the door, would you mind closing that door for us, please? And then if you'd stand and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
First up is item number 3, discussion of possible action, approval of the agenda for March 19, 2019. Is there any public comment regarding today's agenda? Hearing none, if I get a motion to approve.
I move to approve.
I'll second.
We move to second to approve today's agenda. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimously. Move along now to item number 4. This is discussion of possible action. Approval of the minutes for February the 5th, 2019. Is there any public comment regarding those minutes? Hearing none, if I get a motion to approve.
I move to approve.
I'll second.
Moved and seconded to approve the minutes for February the 5th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries unanimously. On now to item number 5, discussion of possible action. Approval of the minutes for February the 19th, 2019. Is there any public comment regarding those minutes? Hearing none, if you get a motion to approve.
I'll move to approve.
I'll second.
Moved and seconded to approve the minutes for February 19th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Move along now to item number 6. This is the consent agenda for today. Is there any public comment regarding today's consent agenda? Hearing none, I get a motion to approve.
I move to approve.
I'll second.
Moved and seconded to approve today's consent agenda. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion carries. Moving along now to item number 7. This is discussion only. We'll take no action or public comment. First up is item A. These are committee and staff reports. I'd like to start on the right side of the room with Sheriff Antonoro.
Good morning. Just a few things. First, with everybody knows about the explosion that happened last week, I just wanted to express my appreciation for all of the folks who participated in that. We had a CERT call out who assisted with traffic control, the deputies, fire department, public works, even citizens who were involved with helping with that. From a public safety perspective, I think it was managed about as well as it could have been under the circumstances. So I wanted to express that. You've got a few, I know you have legislative updates on here, but there's a couple of things we wanted to specifically address coming out of the legislature that may not necessarily have hit that list. First one is Assembly Bill 301, which, if passed, would require that we agendize quarterly reports on the meetings here of the conditions of the jail, because they want the commission to be more involved with the safety, security, and health and welfare of the inmates. So if that passes, that's one more thing to add to the commission meeting agendas. Assembly Bill 291 goes back to the thing we've seen with gun control, expanded background checks, and the sanctuary counties that different places have been doing in the last few weeks. This would prevent that, but it's fraught with several different things. It just creates more of a mess of things. Ultimately, you'd wind up with what we had several years ago where Clark County's doing their thing and Washoe County's doing their thing, and it just going to create a nightmare. So that's one to watch for there. The only thing good on that bill is it now will lower the blood alcohol content of someone in possession of a firearm to a .08 to match what it is for driving a motor vehicle. So as it stands right now, you can be drunk or in possession of a gun than you can be driving a car. And in their supreme wisdom, no idea how they come about it, but Senate Bill 346 will raise the acceptable level of marijuana in someone's system before they're deemed to be impaired from 2 nanograms up to 100 nanograms. And then the bill also includes a study to figure out just what impairment is when it comes to marijuana. But in the meantime, we're just going to raise it through the ceiling. So some things to watch for. Any questions for me?
No. Anything for Sheriff?
Sheriff, is attached to that bill, and I've heard by the grapevine, that there is a part of that bill where when you're interviewing for employment, questions about marijuana use are off the record. And if marijuana use becomes public during someone's employment, that you may not terminate on that basis. Is there any truth to that in this bill?
There is a separate bill. It's not this particular bill, and I don't have that bill number off the top of my head. Basically what it says, with the exception of some exempt position like public safety, fire department, law enforcement, etc., that if it comes to light or if you do pre-employment drug testing, that you cannot use that as an exclusion to hiring somebody. If any of you were hiring employees, did a pre-employment, you cannot use that. Now, if they show up high to work later on, you can still take action against that, but you can't, knowing that they're getting high cannot play into a hiring decision. But it is a separate bill.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Sheriff. Okay, from the, we have two pieces, persons here today. From Community Chest and Library, Sean, are you here to represent them today?
I am not, I'm happy to answer any questions if you'd like.
No questions, thank you. Representing RSVP, Luis Pena.
Yes, Luis Pena. RSVP River District, first of all, I'd like to thank our county commissioners for the support of this program. I'm really getting excited because there's been changes in our community, and with that, I'm getting phone calls for both clients, people wanting to ride and need help with transportation, as well as people willing to drive, which has been really a struggle. We are currently setting up for our van to go to town at least once a week, depending on how popular this gets. And there's interest now on having the van come up here for the county commissioners meeting and activity within Virginia City. So I'm really hepped on that. And I want to thank you for your support and having the patience to wait out the changes. I'd like to thank Sherry and Stacy for their help with this program as well as within Lockwood and the Senior Center. I think it all fits in together. We're Lockwood, Rainbow Bend doesn't like change. I think they're all Lutheran, but just because they don't like change. But once it happens, it seems to be they get to it, but they're fearful of any change. And I'm looking forward to some changes. I think it's going to come down. I want to thank all the help we get from those two ladies. And I'm looking forward to the focus group that's going to come and see what the community has to say. And we're just moving forward, and I'm excited. And again, thank you for your support.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Any questions?
No. Just did a great job down there. Thank you.
Thank you.
tonight down at the Surrey County Senior Center, Stacy Gilbert.
Good morning, Stacy Gilbert, for the record. I just wanted to update everybody on our senior service focus groups. We have one in Mark Twain this week on March 21st at 5 o'clock. Virginia City Senior Service Focus Group will be April 4th at 5 o'clock. And Lockwood was rescheduled to April 18th at 5. And we are also starting a senior nutrition program in partnership with UNR Cooperative Extension. The first class will be April 1st, 10 to 11:15. Any questions?
Great. Thank you, Stacy.
I think also you have one question, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
I think Stacy is now director of the senior centers, plural.
Plural.
If I'm not mistaken.
Great.
So, not yet.
Thank you. I added the yes.
Well, you've done a great job.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Representing community development, Pete Renault.
Nothing to report.
Please. Nothing today. Great. Thank you. Community Relations, Sherry Nevin. Okay.
Good morning, Sherry Nevin for the record. I'm here to report that we have the highly anticipated free dump events in Surrey County scheduled. The first will occur at the Lockwood Landfill for the first, basically, 3 weekends of April. So it'll be a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, April 4th through 6th. 11th through 13th, 18th through 20th. That is open to all Story County residents. So if you have an appetite to drive down to Lockwood, you can use that facility as well. All the information as far as what you can bring, what you can't bring, is on our website. It's also distributed around in the newspapers and such. So it's a long list, and there is some things you cannot take to the landfill. The free dump event here at the Virginia City Transfer Station will be May 2nd through 4th. Again, that's a Thursday through Saturday from 8 to 4. They are closed from 12 to 1 for lunch. This is open to all Story County residents. We've had some issues in the past with them turning folks away who maybe live in Mark Twain because they have a Dayton address, or the Highlands because they have a Reno address. I've provided them with a list of all the streets, so that shouldn't happen. We didn't notice too many issues last year, so... if that does happen, get in touch with us, and we'll make arrangements to make sure that they can get in there and dump their debris. So, again, with that, there is a list of acceptable items. It's not you can go multiple times. You know, basically you get one chance to dump, and then they will charge you after that. So any questions, let me know. Otherwise, there is additional information on our website.
Can you repeat the dates for Lockwood, please?
Yeah, the 4th, April 4th through 6th. 11 through 13, 18 through 20.
And BC is only one weekend?
Yes, May 2nd through 4th.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Sherry. All right. Director of the BCTC, Denny Dodson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, Denny Dodson. Sometime around March 1st, I reached over to one of our longtime board members, Ron Gallagher, and I asked, hey, would you say us a little prayer to St. Patrick for St. Patrick's Day? Because at the time, we had about 2 feet of snow, and it wasn't really looking that well. But it must have worked, because Saturday, it was absolutely gorgeous, perfect weather, and everything hit on all cylinders. I don't think we could have got any more people in the town. And it was very welcomed for all the merchants in town. I had my chance to walk the boardwalk yesterday, and overwhelmingly just people, very positive comments on the event. Obviously, when we do get large amount of people, we always have traffic concerns. We have not enough restrooms, not enough garbage cans, places to eat, but we're addressing those. So anyway, great way to start off the major event season this year. As we speak, they're setting up for our second decent event. We have the International Collegiate Mining Competition. We have about 250 athletes coming in tomorrow night. A welcome reception at the Red Dog. And they'll be partaking in a lot of things here in town, as well as competing over the next 3 days down at the fairgrounds. The major competition is on Saturday. Alumni and co-ed is on Friday. But if you get a chance to go down there, it's an event that should play close to all of our heart. as this is a, obviously, mining is why we're here. And this event hosts folks from all over the world. So kind of a unique experience for us to host this event. And then finally, commissioners, we met last week with the VCTC, and tentatively we did approve our budget. It's just under $1.6 million this year. Expenses are just about 1.56, so we've got a little bit of a cushion going into this next fiscal year. With that, we have our biggest note that I'd like to put our hat on is we've increased marketing, general marketing, upwards over $75,000 for this next year. A lot of it is due to the additional revenue that we are receiving from the property and tribe. So with that, if you have any questions, that's all I have today.
Any questions? Denny? Huh? Great. Thank you, Denny.
Yep.
All right. Operations and project manager, Mike Northan.
I don't think
there's... Okay. Thanks, Mike. County Fire Chief, Jeff Nevin.
Good morning. For the record, Jeff Nevin. Just a couple of things. On March 9th, we had a structure fire in Painted Rock that destroyed the interior of a travel trailer. I believe it was being used as a resident. Unfortunately, four pets lost their lives during that due to smoke inhalation. But that was mitigated quickly with the help of our partnering agencies, Truckee Meadows and North Lyon County. So that was taken care of pretty quick. As we all know, the incident we had at the Delta last week, I just want to echo the sheriff's comments and thank everybody for their cooperation and participation. The investigation is continuing, so they're exhausting all possible causes, and once we have that, we'll make sure we get that out. So, our pile burning, as some people may have seen along Geiger Grade at the county line, continues. We've made quite a bit of progress, almost 60 piles, I believe, at last count, getting rid of some of that dead and down, cleaning up the stands to make that a little bit healthier, hopefully. So. And finally, we're contemplating extending our burn permits for the Mark Twain Painted Rock area into the middle of next month, depending upon weather. So if we do that, we'll get that out to everybody in some media releases. So that's all I have. If you have any questions.
Anything for the chief? Oh, great. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
All right. We have attendance today. Our Justice of the Peace, Eileen Harrington, giving first today. Great. Thank you. Director of Public Works, Jason Wierzbeski.
Morning. Jason Wierzbeski for the record. As some of you guys know, last week we attended the Nevada Rural Water Conference that was hosted at the Nugget. And on Thursday's rewards lunch, we were honored with winning the best tasting water in Nevada. And, you know, we won by smell, clarity, and taste. Next February, we'll be pulling another sample and be on our way to Washington, D.C. for the National Rural Water Association contest. So, any of you guys have any questions?
No.
Great job.
It's almost
we're very confident in you that we're going to win some awards in Washington.
It's still almost 10 years to the day since we won the last one. It was a 2009. Yeah. So
nice.
It's pretty awesome.
Right. Throw those plastic bottles away in Virginia City.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks, Jason. All right. All major projects under water and sewer. Mike Nevin.
Okay, thank you, commissioners. For the record, Mike Nevin. I'll give you a couple of brief updates, both on the Gold Hill sewer project and the Phase 1A of the 5-mile project, and that's the replacement of the hillside tanks. To start with on the sewer project, and as you're well aware, you know, we've been at this for months now. And last June, we prepared a document for the Clean Water Bureau of NDEP in Carson City, that basically the findings were that the outflow from a small package plant in Gold Hill would not adversely affect the Carson River. On the 20th of February, we were called to a meeting at the NDEP headquarters in Carson City, and at the meeting were folks from their regulatory clean water permits and the SRF funding staffs. They have a new bureau chief in the Clean Water Division, Elizabeth Kingsland. She kind of led the meeting. Basically, the nuts and bolts of the meeting is that NDP is finally in agreement with the report that was prepared. And one thing that they noted was as a result of a field trip that we provided for them in January, they have been able to come to the conclusion that the navigable river, it's navigable because it's recognized by the US EPA as such, the Carson River, that there would be no outflow from the proposed plant. In other words, it would be insufficient to maintain a surface hydraulic connection to the Carson River. So that's good news, because what it means now is we can move forward with the proposal for a small package plant, probably a 10,000 gallon per day. It'll remain as a Class 3 plant, which also means the operational side of things is consistent with what we're doing here in Virginia City to treat sewage. And so we do not have to have our operators seek a higher level of certification, pretty expensive. It would have been a Class 4. They can maintain it at a Class 3, and that's the same as we're running here in the Virginia City plant. Jason Cooper, who's the Administrative Services Officer with the SRF, and SRF is a state revolving fund and loan grant folks. They run the program. He was at the meeting in attendance as well. He indicated to us that this project remains as a Class 1A funding priority, and he has set a placeholder aside for the project of up to $1.2 million if needed. The good thing about the Class A number one priority is they will provide up to $500,000 in principal forgiveness for the project. It could be more, depending on how it all shakes out in the end. So that's a positive outcome. So after that meeting, we all put our heads together, got together with your staff, the folks at Far West, to see how we're going to put the plan together moving forward, specifically with the funding application that's required for the project. So we've been doing a lot of research of recent, getting all the environmental assessment information down to the folks at SRF, because a lot of that work had been done as part of the Virginia City Gold Hill project initially. So, you know, we're not reinventing the wheel, so to speak, along those lines. We discussed the application project and the criteria for meeting all the requirements within that program, and we're confident that we'll be able to submit that here within 2 weeks to the board as an agenda item. Sherry is preparing the documentation necessary for this project, so staff will be here as well as folks from Far West, and we'll have further discussions regarding moving forward with the funding part of that piece. And it's our hopes that this project will be completed by year's end. So that's the update on the Gold Hill project. On the water project, basically the hillside tanks, as you recall, we had funds left over from the pipeline portion of the project. And as it turns out, that funding that's available as what I call leftover money comes from both the construction side and from project inspection. So the end result was we had about $596,000 available to us. We had previously met with the USDA about utilizing that to replace these aging tanks, one of which is so bad that it can't be bubble gummed together anymore. And Jason will attest to that if you have any questions regarding it. But anyway, they suggested that what we needed to do was to write an amendment to the owner-engineer agreement for the project to get the design in motion. We presented all that paperwork to USDA, and on February 28th, they concurred that the amendment was satisfactory. So what that does is, out of that $596,000, it takes $164,500 or so and puts that in to management and design for the project. So that gives us about $431,000 remaining to put towards construction. We would still be short about $360,000, and USDA doesn't like to just fund part of a project. It has to be a complete project. So we decided to break it down into two phases. Phase one would be replacement of the smaller tank. That's a 90,000-gallon tank. We would replace that with a 500,000, a half a million, because here in the community we are short for storage for fire protection. That would at least get us rolling, you know. So we asked USDA, well, how would we go about requesting additional loan and or grant funding for that project? And they said, well, that's possible. So that paperwork is in motion. I spoke with Cheryl Couch and her staff last week at the water conference in Sparks, and they're on board with providing us with the additional funding that will be needed for that project. So replacing both those tanks, the engineer's estimate is about 1.7 mil. It could be as low as about 1.3. The thing about it is there's a couple of unknowns, and one of which is pretty huge, is we may be able to rehab one of the existing tanks, the larger of the two tanks. So Jason has reached out to a couple of tank specialists that do this kind of rehab work. It's called basically recoating both the interior and exterior of those tanks. And so if that's a possibility, we'll save about $485,000 to do that.
Mike, if I may, sure. When you're quoting the numbers 1.7 or 1.3, is that per tank or for both?
No, that would be both. That would be the entire project, yes.
We've probably for pretty good tanks. Price, actually.
Yeah. So
I've seen them go for well over $1 million individually a piece.
So probably what we're going to do is, you know, seek the higher, you know, amount of money from USDA. And Cheryl did tell me that there is, you know, a possibility that some of that could be in the form of a grant like we've received before. The good thing there, too, on the loan side, I know the paperwork is in motion, and we have a conference call with them next Tuesday. We still are at that level where they call it the poverty level for interest rate on the loan, which I think is around 2%, a little over 2%. 2.5%. So that's in our favor as well. So we're looking at all those possibilities. But, you know, we'll at least get the one tank, you know, done and over and done with. But it'd be nice to get it all done while we've got a project in motion, of course.
Would the second tank also be 500,000 gallons?
Like? Yeah, they'd both be 500. So we'd have 1 million gallons of fresh water.
Replacing a 90,000, and what's the second tank we'd be replacing?
250.
Okay.
The existing. Yeah.
So we replace 240 with 1 million.
Right.
Okay.
We have a pretty aggressive timetable for the project. Design is in motion. And we anticipate being able to go to bid in June or so with an award late June, early July, with construction starting hopefully immediately, and the project should wrap up by the end of the year as well. So it's our hopes that both these projects will finally be put to bed by the end of this year. You got any questions?
Yeah.
We'll keep you updated.
Thanks for the update, Mike. Sounds like it's pretty good news. All right. Over at the comptroller's office, Mr. Gallagher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the record. Hugh Gallagher, Story County Comptroller. At your next commission meeting, we'll be going over the tentative budgets on April 2nd. We have finished our round. We'll go take a pass through Pat to see if we've got an up and down to move forward next week. I want to take this opportunity to thank all the department heads. They did just a brilliant job on their budgets. I still have some concerns, but that will hopefully materialize or dematerialize when I get revenue numbers from taxation next Monday. Final figures for that are for ad valorem, personal and real, are due on Monday. So we'll see what happens there. During the weekend, I was having a lot of conversations with our lobbyists about what's happening in the legislature. I wrote down a couple of things that may be of your that you may have some attention for. One is the behavioral health. Is they're trying to get $1.4 million worth of funding for most of those programs. Our fuel tax bill looks like it's doing well, and that is for diesel tax, understanding that we don't have a diesel tax. Hopefully that will give us some leeway to in order to do that specifically in the industrial park area where there's a lot of it. There's a lot of collective bargaining bills. The biggest one is it reverses all of the collective bargaining things that were done in 2015. I mean, there's literally a dozen, and people are trying to get some of those bills consolidated. Yesterday was the last time a bill could be presented, or it's dead, with the exception of those with appropriations, and I think next Monday, I think, is the deadline for those. So I've got probably no less than 150 or 200 emails on bills that were just presented yesterday. So we'll take a little time and go through those.
Do you have a feel how many bills were presented yesterday, Hugh?
There's so many of them. I'm getting them from Murray Walker, and I'm also getting them from legislature. There's probably 250, I would think.
I've heard between 300 and 500.
Yeah.
I think the 500
is a 500.
Yeah. I believe it is.
That list is long. So the other thing is that the ending fund balances that we can exclude as far as bargaining is probably a good positive thing that, or it's not positive, but it's going from 25% of your ending fund balance down to 16.67. There's a lot of other bills on workman's comp to where it's almost going to be up to the county or the government to prove that the person didn't receive the accident on the job instead of vice versa. Those things are still pending. There are a lot of public works bills. Obviously, prevailing wage is one. It's going down from the current. Everything's now going to stay where it was before the last legislature, probably at 100,000. And there's a one in there on apprenticeships for counties, and I just don't. It's a lot of people. The unions are having a very good time doing some of this stuff. So we're just going to have to see where all of this comes out. There are a ton of water bills that are out there. The only one specific probably to us is the Frank Down Decree and Marlette Lake or in Hobart Reservoir. Those are still in committee. The other various bills, seems to be a lot of attention on mental health bills this year. There are some bills looking at our open meeting law to make it a little more restrictive. State park bonds are now back on the agenda. Actions against local governments. They're trying to liberalize what people can sue the county for or have actions against the county, a county or city government. And then the one that Lance mentioned to the sheriff, denial of employment due to marijuana. I don't know what we're going to do with human resources when somebody comes in like that, but we're just going to have to say you can't deter somebody from employment just because they test for marijuana. There's another one that was I don't have a real good grasp on. It's a regional planning by Skip Daly, and I think Pat will do that. There is a bill that would have a court reporter in at every single open meeting that we have. That I don't think is going to go. Same day elections, I think. From the last time I heard, took a real hit in committee, and so we don't know if that's going to survive. And tort actions, it's always brought up by various attorneys because they live on that stuff. And we'll just have to see. So that's my report for now, Mr. Chairman.
Well, if I should say thank you or not for that, you. This is why the voters only give the legislature 120 days to cram out a bunch of terrible legislation. Chief Deputy District Attorney, Mr. Loomis.
Nothing today, Mr. Chairman.
County Manager, Mr. Whitten.
Well, I'll jump in on the pending legislation. There is so much going on down there that as he was speaking, the sheriff let me know that there are so many bills, Commissioner Yeoman, you asked, that are still not being cranked out, I would presume, by LCB, because the creation of a bill, as we learned last time with the V&T Railroad, is a quite arduous process that leadership has apparently extended the deadline for submission of bills to be March 29th now. So it's got to be an interesting session from everything I'm hearing. Bum Hess is keeping us up to date. Mary Walker is. We've got a couple of other bills that I became aware of late last week that I'm waiting to have come out of that process. So the one thing that Comptroller Gallagher did mention is Assemblyman Daly's bill. That's AB 240. You might recall at the last session in 17, he introduced a pretty caustic bill that would require any projects practically that we do regionally to really get the okay and the blessing from everybody else. In 2 years, I think he's listened and rethought. He now has a bill out there that essentially says the five counties, Lyon, Carson, Douglas, Story, and Washoe,
as well as the cities of Reno and Sparks, need to get together, I think it's two times a year, as I recall, and kind of hold hands and say kumbaya. Just talk about what we're doing, which is stuff we're doing already anyway. We're doing it with Lee Gibson and the RTC. We're doing it, heck, our four counties, Lyon, Carson, Douglas, and Story, have a common lobbyist. So it's really just asking for the things we do. And then there is a reporting mechanism, I think, once a year, with really no specifics at this time. So we've opted to stay neutral on it. It's not a bad thing to encourage governments to talk to each other, if that's as far as it goes, and that's the most we get out of it. Moving on to two other quick items so we can get on with regular business. It's that time of year where...
Let me just follow up on the legislative actions on this. Is that for some of you that might not know, that the county manager and Austin Osborne and Hugh Gallagher and myself, we meet on a biweekly basis with our four-county legislative coalition in Carson City, and we meet with our lobbyists. And so we get to go over all the issues that Mr. Gallagher just brought up. But a question that arose is why Mr. Gallagher gives this report and not our lobbyists. Well, the reason our lobbyists don't give this report is because they're at the legislature doing what they're getting paid for. So we don't want them taken away from being at the legislature when somebody might want to cram through one of these terrible pieces of legislation that Mr. Gallagher just informed us about. So that's why Mr. Gallagher gives the report and not our lobbyists. They will give us a full recap of the legislature after the session has ended in June. So just so you know where we are and why we're there. So
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Great point. It's that time of year again where we need to assess where we are in our benefits coverages, particularly medical, dental, vision, and life. We do this through our insurance broker, Kevin Monahan at LP Insurance. Between he and Jesse, they've been working hard on it, and here's a quick status update. We're going to move medical and dental coverage from Hometown Health to Cigna, effective May 1st. Hometown Health had stuck to a 12% increase on our current medical plans, our biggest expense component. Truly, that wasn't unreasonable in light of our continued claims losses. We are at 120% loss ratio over the last 12 months, much too high to not expect costly increases. Coverage was shopped to the entire marketplace by Kevin. Cigna was the most competitive. Cigna's offers include a 4.1% increase to medical, a 10% limit on next year's renewal with a couple of caveats. Those are subject to no new taxes or fees being introduced into the medical industry and our enrolled population not changing more than plus or minus 10%. We also get, on top of that, a $50,000, I'm going to call it a signing bonus. Kevin called it a credit, which will be applied to one of our earlier invoices. Maybe not in the first or second month, but subsequently we'll get an automatic credit for $50,000. All benefits are, current benefits are preserved. There's no change. And in fact, they're expanded. We can now use both the St. Mary's and Renown networks as opposed to just the Renown networks. And we have expanded national access. Care can be received outside of Nevada without approval from the insurance company. So all in all, a good switch. United Health wanted a 31% increase on dental coverage. We shopped again the entire marketplace. Cigna's offer was 4.2% above current premiums and was selected since they included a 1% reduction off of our medical premiums by bundling and getting the discount. And our vision and life insurance are mid-contract, so we'll look at those actually in 2020. Okay? And lastly, work continues primarily with myself, Chief Deputy D.A. Loomis, and others in assessing whether or not staff will ultimately consider recommending to the Story County Board of Commissioners to make whatever legal document changes that would allow them under NRS to sit also as the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center GID Board of Trustees. Again, as I've stated before, there is no obligation on the county as far as fiscal obligation or liability. We've got, in my opinion, two of probably the state's at least best attorneys. Keith is extremely well-versed in GIDs, and Bob is well-versed in tri-GID. We have an individual out there doing operational due diligence that Keith and I met with, I think, last week, that gave us an update on where he is with his due diligence. We should have a report. And that meeting with Mike Workman made me and Keith realize that we're covering two out of three bases. Operationally, I think Mike, with his experience at Lyon County and Dig Utilities, will be able to tell us the operational health of the GID. Legally, I've got that one's well handled. But we haven't done fiscal. So in that process, I have reached out to a CPA that does GID audits, very familiar with him, with them, and he was contemplating that. He has not gotten back to me yet, but trying to talk to any accountant between now and April 15th is usually a pretty tight, high task. But try again through Mr. Sater has graciously said, of course you need to do that, and we will reimburse the county for the expenses the CPA charges, so we'll have a similar contract agreement before you someday down the road. That's my update.
Great. Thanks, Pat. Next up, County Clerk Vanessa Stevens. Nothing today. All right, that concludes the committee and staff reports. We'll move along now to item number 8. These are board comments. We'll take no action to public comment. Start down at the far end of the table. Commissioner Carbone.
Just wanted to mention that I was fortunate enough to judge the festival we had this weekend. I was very pleased with the turnout. I just wanted to give kudos to the VCTC, to Liquid Blue. I think they put on a great event, and I look forward to next year.
Yeah, great. And to Ron Gallagher for that Irish prayer. Sir?
Yep, and Ron.
Vice Chair, Mr. Gilman.
Yes, I'd like to give a report this morning. I had the honor of going back and representing Story County with NACO board in Washington, D.C., and I was joined by Chairman Marshall McBride and of course, Pat Whitten, County Manager. And it was an eye-opening and very, very interesting week. And so I wanted to share a few thoughts from that. My first visual concept that I had in going back there is that every county in the United States was there represented by either a commissioner or a county manager or someone. And it was like a whole nest of little birds all wanting to be fed by the high leadership over back there. Everyone has their list of the things that are important to their county, and it's like feeding from fire hose, I think, trying to drink from it with everybody back there. But it was fascinating to be able to review a lot of the issues. We had a number of breakfasts, and so, for example, one of the things that we're focused on is our senior centers and our senior support programs here in the county. And there'll be a lot of focus on that this year. Well, as luck would have it, I ran into the folks that had chaired a similar challenge nationally, and so they had feedback from every single county as to what worked in their counties and what senior services were available. And so there's a plethora of information there that will support what we're thinking about and where we're going to do. But we were able to compare a lot of the jurisdictions and some of the problems that or challenges that we face here in the county and how they've been managed in other places. We also were allowed quite a number of one-on-one legislative meetings. So we met with Congresswoman Dina Titus. Mark Amadei, of course, is always an open door for all of us. Stephen Horsford, Senator. He spent two separate days with us going over everything happening and that we were interested in Story County. And, of course, Susie Lee, we didn't get to meet with her, but we did meet with her staff. And one of the things I wanted to mention that are interesting when you go back there and you hear what's happening to all the counties is I think probably you all know that Two-thirds of our county are 65 years of age and older. So we're an aging community, and we have a lot of need for safe senior services. But I'm not sure that everybody realizes that out of all the revenues that we enjoy each year, 85% of that goes to the payrolls and the health and the services for three unions in our county. So the fire department, the sheriff's department, and our public service unions enjoy over 85% of all revenues. Well, that doesn't leave us very much as a county, maybe 10 to 15% given the day, that actually can go into senior services taking care of our infrastructures or all of the things that we need to look at. And we're pretty thin on the dollars. And so it's interesting when you get back there because we say a word that really means a lot more to me today, and it's called unfunded mandate. And so what is an unfunded mandate? Well, that's something that back in Washington, our leadership decides that all counties in the nation are going to have to pay for. And so that comes back to the legislative session that we're talking about right now. What are they going to decide we all have to do as a county that we have to pay for? And we only have 10 to 15% of our dollars to pay for all those things. And so the fight is, let's hold on to all the money we possibly can to serve our county the way we want to. But it starts in Washington, D.C., and so we can do the proper management and lobbying that we have to do. As a part of NACO, I call in to the NACO board every Friday at 3 o'clock. And usually it goes about 2 hours. And we review every bill that may have an impact or a severe unfunded mandate impact upon our county. And so every legislative session and what they're doing back in Washington, we all need to watch very carefully because they'll spend our money and we'll come back here and say, how in the world are we going to get through the knothole on this thing? So that was very interesting. The other thing that was interesting is we had the opportunity to meet with the majority of the department heads on the federal level. So, for example, Department of Transportation, Human Resources, Employment and Training, Economic Development, Veterans Affairs. And I would say that the primary conversation that's circling in all of those meetings that we're listening to really have to do with deregulating our nation because we have such a tremendous pile of regulations on small business or on counties or on individuals, and they don't go away. You know, they don't sunset. They are there forever. And so the administration in Washington today has been really focused on deregulating our nation. And one of those examples is we all struggle with road building, highway, and what can the federal do, and what can the state do, and we can't build state money without federal funds. And so what goes into all this regulatory environment? And I think it's been said before, generally, just to get a permit to work on one of our highways that have federal funds or a federal highway, it takes up to 9 years just to get the environmental permit. So something we want to do tomorrow that we really need to do is going to be tied up in the environmental side. Their goal right now is to move that back to a minimum of 2 years and see if we can expedite so that we're more flexible on responding to the things that our individual counties need. Of course, all the counties are back there. We also had a lot of discussions on the opportunity zones. And as you probably all know, we were successful in a very special and unusual challenge. We were able to convert Story County to an opportunity zone. And up until that time, we were not included and should have been. It was overlooked. So what does opportunity zones mean to us? Well, it means that there's a phenomenal amount of stranded capital that wants to go into projects that can defer their taxes. And it was primarily focused on folk like the areas in downtown Reno that are blighted areas or in the counties that are blighted. But it turns out it works well for all of us. So today, Story County is an opportunity zone, all of it. And so that means that we have some opportunities for Virginia City and for our communities. How it's going to be implemented, we don't know for sure yet because the Treasury and the IRS are still generating the rules and regulations we're going to have to follow. Where does the money come in? And is there an LLC? And how is it managed? And many of those things aren't known yet. But once they are known, it's going to open up our little Story County to some pretty incredible funds. And the last thing I want to mention is that you have the opportunity to dig out some what I would call nuggets of opportunity. And so one of them is a program that I don't believe anybody was really aware of. And it kind of came out by accident during the opportunity zones. But there is a separate federal fund. It's called the CIPRO fund. And that fund has nothing to do with opportunity zones. And there is $88 million sitting in that fund today that any county in the nation can apply for. And most of them don't even know it exists. And 50% of that money that you get as a county allocated must be used for young folks, 18 of age, 18 years or younger. So money that can go into youth centers or youth programs or youth health programs, a half a year allocation. So there's a fund back there that we are going to focus on and see what kind of money we can bring to Story County. But it was a fascinating meeting. I enjoyed it a lot, and I can see where unfunded mandates are a real challenge for us. So thank you for the time. I hope that was informative.
Great. Thanks, Lance. Yeah. So I don't have anything today, so why don't we go ahead and we'll move right along now to item number 9. Discussion only. No possible action. Public comment allowed.
Who wants to take the lead? You or Linda?
Linda's going to go ahead and
you want to come on up and
review, and then I'll...
Linda Ritter to everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Board. Linda, for the record, Linda Ritter Consulting. We are here today to interview three candidates for county manager. I want to go over where we've been, how we've gotten to this point. We posted the position announcement online January 8th. It was on governmentjobs.com, which is a very popular website for people in this business to look for employment, and it was on the website. We also submitted that or sent that position announcement with a personal note from Pat to every county and to rural cities within Nevada looking for candidates that might already be in the state. As of February 1st, which was the date we set out to start reviewing applications, we received 18 applications and received 2 verbal expressions of interest. Those expressions of interest did not culminate in applications, however. Pat and I both reviewed every application that came through. We each independently came up with who we felt should qualify for the next step, which was a telephone interview. And between us, we came up with 8 applicants to interview by telephone, which we did. We actually interviewed 7. We invited them for interview. 1 did not get back to us to take us up on that offer. Part of that interview was also confirming a couple things with the applicant. Number 1, that they would have to live in Story County, that they would have to be a resident of Story County to serve as the county manager, that the current county manager did not work under a contract and we could not guarantee that a successful candidate would receive a contract, and we also wanted to verify the salary range that was being offered for the position. We wanted to make sure that the person understood that the range was set by the board. So of those, we had 7 that we selected for interview, felt that we're qualified to go to interview to the next step, which was before a panel of citizens and a separate panel of staff people. Prior to the interview, those interviews, 3 candidates withdrew their applications from consideration. 1, because that applicant was given a promotion in their current position. We have to understand the labor market is really tight right now, and good people are very often encouraged to stay, and that's what happened to this one. Another one, because the residency requirement presented a hardship to their family because of other obligations down in the Reno area. And 1, because the salary wasn't quite sufficient for what that applicant required. Prior to the panel interviews, the applicant's education and job history were verified, so we know that everything they put on their application was true and correct. The final 4 candidates were interviewed by the panels on February 26th. What we did was we had those panels pick out their top 2 candidates of those 4, and we combined those, and we came up with the 3 candidates for you. Ron Connect, Austin Osborne, and Marina Works. So between that point and today, we had interviews with, had an interview performed of their personal and professional references, and you should have the notes from those interviews. And we also did a credit history check to make sure there was no any red flags out there. Other written references have been submitted, and you should have those in your packet. And so that's where we are. That's how we came to this point. We have our first candidate out in the hall ready to come in, but I know Pat would like to review the process with you once more so everybody understands how this is going to proceed. But we are starting with Ron Connect, after that Austin Osborne, and then finishing up with Marina Works. Any questions?
Okay. In talking briefly individually with some of you this morning, it dawned on me that we probably need to kind of explain what our thought process is as you go through the interview, both for you folks and also for the public that has taken the time to be here today. I want to thank Linda profusely. I couldn't have done this by myself. She has just been a lifesaver, so much so that when she met Erlene last night for the first time, I think Erlene referred to her as the other woman, because we've been talking on Saturdays and Sundays and just trying to keep this thing, you know, on a good, solid track. So thank you, Linda. So what we anticipate today is much the same as what we structured for the two interview panels. We'd like each of you to ask a total of three questions in a round-robin style. Round-robin to us means that I would recommend to the chair that we start with Commissioner Carmona, and he asks a question. We're going to give each applicant an opportunity to answer that question. And sometimes those answers we found create other follow-up questions. So any of the commission may ask a follow-up question. Now, one thing I want to stress to make clear is, in the interest of fairness, the initial question that Commissioner Carmona asks will be asked of each candidate exactly the same way. So we're not cherry-picking the questions based on who the individuals are, or what we may or may not know about them in their packets, or from last night. Then Commissioner Gilman would get to ask a question. Same routine, 5 minutes allotted, followed by Commissioner McBride. We cycle through that a total of three times. I'm leaving out some of the obvious stuff. Chairman McBride's going to make a few opening remarks, welcome the candidate. That probably won't take 5 minutes to be candid. The candidate gets 5 minute opening remarks. You got about 45 minutes allotted for the question and answer portions of this. And then the candidate will be allotted a 5 minute closing as well. Are there any questions from any of you on that? Okay. The candidates are aware of this because, again, we did this in the panel. There will be two tools running. There will be a 5 minute countdown timer. And at approximately the 1 minute mark, although sometimes I get so engaged in the Q&A process, I miss a little bit. But I will hold up for both you and the candidate a 1 minute remaining. Please keep in mind that you are making a very, I know you know this, so you're making a big decision. And the last thing I want to do is cut off the three of you from getting the answers that you want to your questions, or in fairness, cutting off the candidate and fully answering the question. So you'll see some flexibility there. This is just meant to try to keep the interviews to about an hour. At the end of each panel, of each applicant's interview, Linda and I anticipated the opportunity for question and answer, but suggest to the chair that this is not an opportunity for questions and answers. These are just overall comments and observations. The individuals had plenty, ample opportunity and almost 90 minutes of that at the meet and greet last night. So that is the process, and if you all are ready, we're ready to begin.
Yeah.
And I might add, each of the other two candidates have volunteered to be excluded from the previous interviews.
I'd like to introduce Ron Connect.
Thank you.
Good morning, Ron.
Good to see you, Mr. Chairman.
Ron,
Commissioner. Oops, nice to see you. How you doing today, Commissioner?
I'm told I have to call him Pat.
There you go.
Good to see you.
So,
For most of us, Mr. Connect doesn't need an introduction. He served on the University Board of Trustees, and he was most recent in the Comptroller's Office in Carson City. Wanted to start off by saying that I've sat on some interview panels before for hiring directors of different departments within the county, and then of course in private business I've done a lot of interviews for individuals for different capacity. This is the first time this board is going to interview anybody for the job of county manager. Pat Witten's been the county manager for a long time. He was our first county manager. And so we have about 12 or 14 years then?
Oh, five, 14 plus.
Over 14 years. So this interview process is going to be a little bit new for us. Go ahead and if you interview who potential next county manager for Story County. So we appreciate the efforts of Linda Ritter going ahead and putting this together for us. We thought this was the best avenue to go. We could have just hired anybody we wanted to with the agreement of the three of us, but we thought it was better to advertise the way that we did. We want to get the best of the best that's out there. And between the two panels that I've interviewed, between our citizen panel and our government panel, we feel that they brought the best of the best to us. And so with that, Mr. Connect, thank you for being here today, and thank you for coming to the meet and greet last night. Thank you for your interest in Story County. And with that, Mr. Carmona, if you would like to start the questions at your end.
I would. Ron.
Oh, well, excuse me. The candidate gets 5 minutes to be able to tell us about himself. Excuse me.
Pardon me. I guess I should read the script a little bit better. All right. Mr. Connect, opening statements, please.
You want to hear about me, I take it, in 5 minutes.
That's all you get.
That's more than enough. First of all, thank you for the opportunity. The process, I think, has been outstanding. I think it's a great opportunity because Story County has a bright future, and I'd very much like to be part of that as county manager, work with you all, succeed Mr. Witten. I will admit you have two other very fine candidates. And so obviously the process has worked, and I look forward to your questions. I was born in a small town in the Midwest, and I think two of you last night heard, Commissioner Gilman, you may not have heard, that being born in a small town in southern Illinois, of course, like Abe Lincoln, I was born in a log cabin. In my case, it was a log cabin I helped my father to build. And if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you, too. I was a math nerd and a distance runner in high school and college. Went to the state university. First job full-time out of college was as an assistant city engineer for the city of Urbana, where I worked with planning and even sewers and bicycle paths and the whole range of stuff that the city engineer folks do. And I also served on the Board of Zoning Appeals in Urbana, so I got some experience early on with that. Dropped out of grad school at Illinois in 77, 78 to come west to be a minor cog in the first Jerry Brown administration as a commissioner's senior advisor at the California Energy Commission. Ultimately, being a child of the 60s and 70s, got to where I wanted to be a year later when I transferred down to the California Public Utilities Commission as their senior economist and financial and policy analyst. Spent some time there, learned a lot from it, and then got seduced into consulting from 1986 on. with three different firms, but it was really variations of the same thing. You know, these entrepreneurial businesses, these boutique firms in Silicon Valley, tend to start up and somebody spins off. We went through all that. I did a lot of work as an expert witness and a consulting executive. Oh, by the way, back in Illinois, I had another experience with local government when I was part owner of a restaurant that we built and opened and ran for 3.5 years. Unfortunately, and you all can relate to this, I think, we took out the construction loan before the Saturday night massacre in October of 79, and our interest rate when we turned it over went from 7% to 17%, and that kind of dictated a short life, but we made it to 3.5 years. So from when I got to California and after I served in public service and went to consulting, went back to grad school at Stanford in engineering economic systems, but there was a lot of practical public policy stuff there too. And then, as I like to joke, I in the 90s went all the way to the bottom and went to law school. I have the greatest respect for lawyers, I really do. Finally, grew up enough to get married. 1 minute to go. Real quickly, grew up enough to get married 20 years ago. Have my sainted wife and awesome daughter with us here today. And after a while, we realized we had enjoyed as much California as we could stand. We moved back to the same side of the Sierra. Next thing you know, I got involved in politics, got elected to the legislature, was one of the mean 15, paid for my job by being one of the mean 15, got elected to the Board of Regents, and that was 8 years of really good experience. Then I ran for controller as one plain speaking nerd, and that really was great preparation as an executive and administrative job for this, and I'll be happy to tell you about that. I just think this is the sort of job that people down in the valley say, you know, that could really be fun. It's a lot of challenge, and I look at it as a great challenge, but it's a great challenge because you all are on the upswing, I would very much like to be part of that and do the job. One final thing. Here's something to understand. I've been a state executive. And I know I had the opportunity as an executive and a specific statutory charge to do political kinds of things, to provide political leadership of ideas and so forth. This is different, and I understand the difference. This would be being the chief administrative officer, working with you three to help you work effectively together and to formulate policy. I wouldn't have a dog in the hunt in terms of policy. It's just helping you and then taking the policy back to the staff and in an executive administrative capacity, leading the staff to implement that policy. So I just want to make sure that you understand. I understand that difference. The other thing would be communicating with the public. I think you all know that that's been one of my strong suits as controller. Put out 4 controllers' annual reports that have never been done. And I think Pat's getting the hook ready, so I'll stop there and take your questions and thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your opening statement, Mr. Kinnick. With that, we'll go ahead and Commissioner Carmona, if you'd like to start the round-robin session.
I'm probably going to pick the best question. So what do you value most about Story County's culture and vision?
Story County's culture and vision, one of the things to value is, you know, Story County's been a population of 4,000 for some time. In the 60s and 70s, it had tough going. And then, in the 90s, a couple of guys named Gilman and Norman had this great idea, and they took a lot of risks, and they built the largest industrial park in the country, and now it's fully subscribed. So now, in addition to 4,000 people and preparing to grow, we've got over 8,000 people employed out there on the other end of the county. And so we've got this really great economic future. At the same time, it's really important to maintain the rural and small town character of Story County, to transition to slow, moderate, controlled growth, where we maintain those values that people that bring people here. I might tell you, by the way, besides coming to various events up here, my wife and daughter love coming to Halloween up here. It's that kind of thing. You know, Virginia City, Gold Hill area attracts 1.6 million people a year as tourists, which is over 1,000 times their population. So we've got to maintain that, maintain the character of the five population centers here, again, small town and rural, and at the same time, embrace the opportunities for growth that Trick and the rest of the area are bringing us. And that's what I value. And, you know, I was hoping to be able to walk to work, but they tell me I won't be able to find a place nearby.
Are there follow-up questions from the commissioners?
Not at this time.
Not sure why you can't find a follow-up place, but something might come up.
Mr. Chairman, anything?
Mr. Gilman?
It's impressive the career you've enjoyed for a lifetime, right? To go back through. I haven't had an opportunity to see your resume. I'm sorry about that. But I enjoyed. You certainly experienced a lot of things, and I'm sure that life challenges, you probably don't have a lot of things that are going to surprise you today in business. I'm going to focus my question a bit more succinctly. Several years ago, our county staff was kind enough to really take a look at and embrace line item budgeting. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that we're probably the only county really successful with that in the state, at least. That's my opinion at this point. And we're very proud of that because, as you say, we have a bright future. And economically, we're going to have a lot to manage as we move forward, more this year and a lot more in 3 or 5.
Yes.
And so I'd like to have your background, feelings, understanding on line item budgeting and how you would oversee and manage that.
Well, first of all, my background with budgeting, obviously as controller, I had to prepare and administer our budgets after I took them to the legislature and explained it all to them and got their concurrence on everything except one item one time, darn it. In addition, by the way, in 2015, I led a team of people, some legislators, legislative staff, citizens, and professionals. We put together an alternate state budget that would have avoided a tax increase. Nonetheless, the legislature, by the way, that passed with flying colors. The legislative council said it would all work and, you know, it would have raised spending just a little bit but not raised taxes. And we got our hearing and it passed and they said, well, we want to raise taxes, we want to raise spending, and so they did. One of the things I think that was important there was having good relations with the budget committee. So here it'll be important to have good relations with three commissioners who will be the ultimate budget arbiters. In terms of line item budgeting, zero-based budgeting, and priority budgeting, et cetera, what I've found is that, and I wrote an article about this a few years back, 10 years back now, in the Chronicle of Higher Education when I was a regent and chairman of the budget committee there. Big problem that the public sector has is we do a bottoms-up kind of budgeting where everybody submits their wish list, line items and otherwise, and then we do a little trimming, and then we say, okay, here's what we need, and here's, therefore, the revenue that we need, And if the revenue that we expect is not enough, we say, oh, I guess we're going to have to raise taxes. Well, maybe, but what we really need in the public sector is to do what you deal with in the private sector, where you say, let's start from the other end. Here's our revenue constraint. Here's what we're going to have available. That's a sober, detailed forecast, but here's what we're going to have available. Then we're going to allocate that among the various functions and departments, and priority-based budgeting does that. And, you know, all of this stuff can be combined into hybrids, priority-based, line item, et cetera. The important thing is you've got to do it in real time. But from my perspective, the important thing is to see if the projected revenues from existing sources can cover everything we need to cover, and only as a last resort start talking about tax increases. I think that's consistent with the way Story County is operated. That's what I will work with the comptroller here, comptroller down there. I will work with the comptroller and the staff to present you a line item budget that meets those conditions on time and gives you the opportunity to, and highlights what the policy decisions are that you need to make in that context. So, you know, if we have to cut $100,000, here are three options, or something like that. 1 minute. All I can tell you is I did spend 2 years, well, I spent 7 years, 8 years on the Board of Regents, on the Budget and Finance Committee, 2 years as chair, 1 year as vice chair, and also spent the same kind of time on the Audit Committee, and again, 2 years as chair, 1 year as vice chair. In many ways, that would be one of my strong suits. Have I addressed line item budgeting enough?
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your field review. Yep.
And one thing I did in the panel that I moderated is Mr. Connect finished a couple minutes early on his last question. So we've got some flex in here. If there are follow-up questions, you'll hear me allow for those. We've got 22 seconds, but again, we can take longer than that. Are there follow-up questions from any of the commissioners?
I have one. So, Mr. Connect, I believe the 2015 tax increase you were talking about was the governor's gross receipts tax. Is that correct?
That was a major part of it.
Okay, and then you had a plan that you would have implemented as opposed to the gross receipts tax. Could you elaborate just a little bit on what your plan would have been and how that would have worked?
Yes, and thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman. Our plan basically was we had to cut back some of the proposed spending increases. Now, we still would have had net increases in those areas. Some of them were in K-12, and we were talking about policies that didn't have high costs but had proven effectiveness by research. But the other thing was, we also saw an opportunity for a new revenue stream, which was so many of the counties, especially the two large ones, in so many of the counties, essentially the loophole for retirement contributions had been exercised to the max, and so essentially the counties and the other local governments were paying the full freight, both the employee contribution as well as the employer contribution. And this was where we needed an opinion from the Legislative Council. We said, let's go back to doing with the public, the local government employees, what all the state employees were subject to, like me, and that is where the employees themselves pay half, and the employer contribution is half. And that would have provided a new source of revenue. It was pretty complex and convoluted, and I have to be candid that not everybody in local government, and certainly not the employee unions, were in favor of it, but it was something that was workable legally and would have produced the revenue.
And that pretty much takes our slack time, gets us back on schedule, but again, but there's flex in this to make sure, are there any other follow-up questions before we move on to the next question?
Okay. Next question is from me, Mr. Connect. Describe one or two specific accomplishments that you are especially proud of over your career and why.
I'll tell you, the first one is I've learned to listen. You know, when you're a young hot dog doing consulting work, expert witness work, and a lot of interesting stuff, but, you know, my original specialty was power-generating economics, and I testify as an expert witness on various proposed nuclear power plants and that sort of thing, and alternatives to it, the whole range of other generation technologies. When you're young, you're pretty full of yourself, okay? Or at least I was. And over time, and I got put into management positions right away at age 29 when I went to the, well, actually before that at the Energy Commission, but at the PUC, served on all the management committees and was a section chief and a supervisor and so forth. I was really good at talking, but I learned that you got two of these, one of these, and maybe that is the right proportion to use them. And I've learned to listen to people, and you find out what the problem is. You don't come in and say, well, I know what the problem is, and here's the solution. You listen to the staff. You listen to the public. You certainly listen to the commissioners. I think one of the greatest experiences I'm going to have if I'm selected is to apprentice under Pat Whitten. So learning to listen and then take things back and think about it and ask questions and come back with a thoughtful solution instead of coming in and thinking you know everything. So, and that's certainly true when you're dealing with Story County coming up from the Capitol. We don't know everything. Shoot, the state has plenty of problems that it hasn't solved yet. So I think listening. The other thing, over the course of my career, I think is this. I've had the opportunity, I've had the benefit of a wide range of experience, and a very deep experience in engineering. I still have my engineering registration from 35 years ago in California. I don't purport to be a great engineer right now. I don't want to stamp anybody's plans. But it certainly gives me a basis, a platform for understanding the job that the engineers do, and especially civil and mechanical, which was my area. To me, electrical engineering is still black magic, okay? Then economics and public policy has been my strong suit, but in the latter half of my career, I've focused especially on finance. And that, by the way, is something that I think will be an asset to Story County the way it was to the staff at the controller's office. I can go to the PERS board and say, look, you're estimating too, you're doing a great job of managing the investments, but you're estimating too high a return over the long term from what you're going to get from those investments. And I actually gave them a 12-page detailed technical paper as to why and said, the problem here is if you don't make more conservative estimates of the returns you're going to get, you're going to leave taxpayers and employees and retirees in the lurch by being even more underfunded than you already are. So I guess I would add one more thing. I did go to law school, and that's a really good asset to have when it comes to negotiation, when it comes to overseeing contracts, et cetera. And over time, I've done both supervising managing executive stuff, and I've done top-level professional stuff, and I love both. So those are the two things that stand out. Let me add a third thing, even though you didn't ask for it. One of the characteristics that the job description mentions, and I think it's the first one, is integrity. And providing leadership with integrity, and I think that's so important. You know, one of my friends and one of my acquaintances, one of my former colleagues, just got bounced out of the legislature because of integrity problems. We can't afford that. I believe it's appropriate that you put that as a first qualification, and so that'll be part of my leadership.
Thank you.
Any follow-up questions? Did you have a degree in law school?
Yes, I have a JD. It's a different kind of JD than I aspired to be when I was 15.
I bet. So you didn't practice? Did you get bored?
I didn't take the bar when I got out of law school. I did study a week about 4 years later, which was a little bit too short a time, and I almost passed it on a week or 8 days of study. But really, I went back to what I was doing. Just had the benefit of law school.
Where did you take your law school?
The University of San Francisco.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we're ready for round two, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any follow-up questions?
No, I think you covered everything pretty well. I appreciate it.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and start with the round two.
Why do you want to be Story County's next county manager?
I think this is a great opportunity. It's the combination of professional skills that I bring and executive and management, actually management administrative skills, leadership skills. It's the opportunity to exercise all that with by reputation is a great staff and a great operation, and I know that firsthand from talking to many of them last night and before. It just seems to me like a great opportunity as the capstone of my career. Love to do this for 5 years or so. I don't know if I can do 15, Pat, but it's an exciting place to be. Like I said, we've turned the corner. We have an exciting future, and at the same time, we have this challenge, which I really like, to preserve and extend the small-town rural culture, to work with the small businesses. That's really big up here, and that's important, to work on tourism. I could tell you, I think I said this last night as another joke, when I was campaigning for controller, I told people growing up in a small town in the Midwest, I dreamed of being Nevada State Controller. Everybody got a chuckle out of that, so I said, growing up in southern Illinois, in a log cabin, I dreamed of being Story County Manager. But this is a great place. You know, Ben Cartwright and Adam and Haas and Little Joe always talked about going into Virginia City from the Ponderosa. It's got a magical history, a cachet, and besides which, having been up here a lot, I really like the people. So it seems to me to be just a gem of an opportunity to extend, to use my skills and extend my career. And this would be the capstone. This would be the real crown.
Follow-up questions, commissioners? Hearing none, I guess we're ready for round two.
Okay, Lance.
We followed some parallel path. I enjoyed a little law school too, but I never decided to be an attorney. Thank God. Private company accepted. mentioned it earlier here in the room, but for your sake, our county today is aging. I think you'll find that when you get here that 75%, two-thirds, the majority are over the age of 65. And many are quite a bit older. And in five different communities, it kind of follows that same pattern. So some years ago, we embarked on a path to take a lot of our excess revenues that we believe we're going to have and disperse that through a tax program to our residents. And so we've gone through quite a few maturations on that basis. And it hasn't been a simple task because you got the Board of Taxation and then you've got industrial and you've got residential. And so it's been an uphill battle and disappointing because we haven't been able to identify a vehicle that allows us to do that. So one of the things that a few of us are thinking about today, and I think we're all pretty well joined in the task, is funneling a significant amount of budget to supporting our seniors. And so my thought would be in question is, what experience have you had specifically with seniors and senior issues? And if you and I were just to discuss off the top of your head, what are some of the things you'd recommend for a community to look at for their seniors?
Thank you for that question. A couple things. First of all, I've been a longtime supporter and contributor to FISH down in the valley and around the whole area, previously known as Friends in Service Helping. In fact, I taught a class for them for about 3 or 4 years for their clients on managing your life and personal finances. And it was one of the more satisfying things I've ever done. Second, I am a Kiwanis Club member down in Carson City, and you know, Kiwanis Club has two missions besides fellowship and so forth. Kiwanis Club serves the children and the seniors of the world, and so we have a long history of contributing to, helping raise funds for various senior agencies, etc. And last night at the meet and greet, I talked to the gentleman, and I wish I could remember his name, but he runs a community chest up here. And I bring that up because I think that's one of your better avenues. Indeed, when you talk about serving seniors and serving children and the other needy folks, it's great to work with private agencies, help fund them with some seed money so they get more funding so that they can capitalize on that and go out and do those services. I spent 10 years on the board of court-appointed special advocates down in Carson City, 5 years as chairman, and you know, that of course is oriented toward the neediest of our people, the children who have been mistreated, not treated by their parents and families like they should have been, and others. So I know how well a public-private partnership in charity and in social services works, and that's true for seniors just as much as it is for the children. And I have a long-time interest and commitment at that level, as shown by my Kiwanis membership, CASA board, Kiwanis board, etc., and others. Worked a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit with the folks at the Senior Center down in Carson City. And I will say, had one of the greatest joys of my life was when Kathy and I got married in 98. Along with that came the sainted mother-in-law, the best mother-in-law in the universe in all history. We lost her last year, but you know, having a senior, she was 97 when we lost her. Having a senior in the home, I got to know the senior problems firsthand, dealing with them, And so that would be my answer is, yeah, we can reach out to the state agencies, but let's work with Community Chest and other private groups that can help us too.
So the follow-up, let's assume that you and I are in a conversation over a spike cup of coffee. What are the top two or three things that would come to your mind in a candid conversation that would serve seniors best?
Well, seniors, most of them, unlike my mother-in-law, don't have the benefit of having their daughter and son-in-law and granddaughter at home. So a lot of them need companionship. They need an opportunity to get out. They need, people to spend time with, and not just of their own age, but many of their own age. They need that. Secondly, we have the Meals on Wheels program down in Carson City. Many of them could use a little bit of help preparing food, and that would be another thing that I would be looking at as the one of the two or three. And many of them have transportation needs. And there again, they might have to go into Reno for a doctor's appointment or something like that, or go down to the Social Security office, et cetera. And there are all kinds of shuttles and other services. I might add, am I out of time on this?
Yeah, but we'll let you finish.
Okay.
Thank you.
I've been involved in a, as an investor, supporting a hotel property, a long-term rental property down in Carson City, where almost the whole population is seniors, especially older men who may have served, in the service. And it's just amazing to see what the staff there does to help them. What you really need to do is find people who are committed, who will go the extra effort. Okay, you need to be in Reno tomorrow at 3 o'clock. We'll get you there, et cetera.
Any other pressing follow-up questions?
No, I appreciate the answer. Thanks.
Okay.
That's good. Can you take a sip of water or anything before we go into the next one?
Not blessing me, son.
Yeah. Gives me an opportunity, too.
While we're at it, just for Commissioner Gilman's benefit, since you weren't here last night and you mentioned my resume, it's on the back of there.
That's the fourth annual controller's report.
Well, that's a good one.
I thought so.
Thank
I'm
you.
Proud
I appreciate
of
that.
The other gentleman got that.
Hey, Ron. As a county manager, how much leeway do you give your employees to make decisions, and how will you still maintain control?
This was something that I got great experience in, both in the private sector and back in the state government in California, but also especially here as a regent and as controller. And it comes down to what I call, what people generally call Theory X and Theory Y management. And Theory X, as I understand it, is the idea that if you don't ride herd on people, they'll slack off, they'll take shortcuts, they won't do the job right, they won't get it done on time, on budget, and effectively. So you've got to really be looking over their shoulder pretty much all the time, almost micromanaging them. Theory Y takes the other view of humanity, which is if you give people the resources, if you give them the confidence by telling them, communicating that you will support them and showing them that you will, and if you set expectations very clearly and hold people accountable for meeting those expectations for the schedule, et cetera, the budget and the results, and then you stay out of their way and stay off their backs, people will do remarkable things in that kind of context with that kind of motivation. And that's what I did at the controller's office. The first thing I did, we were inaugurated on Monday, and Tuesday morning I held the first of over 100 biweekly staff meetings. And I would do the same thing here, either weekly or biweekly, with all of my managers. And in this case, I would invite the five electeds also. But we would have these meetings that initially they ran 2 hours or more. As we went on and things got smoother and I learned all the details of what was going on, they got shorter, thank goodness. But you have these biweekly or weekly meetings where you have all the managers, you cover all the coordination, all of what they're doing, all of the problems they face, whether they're on schedule, whether they're delivering, et cetera. And you get everybody coordinated and working together and effectively. I don't have to know everybody's job or know how to do everybody's job to provide the leadership. And that's what I would be doing here, is providing that leadership, that effective management with the context, with the overall view that we're going to give you what you need, we're going to give you the opportunity to excel, and we're going to hold you accountable. That worked very well with staff at the controller's office. At the beginning, you know, they heard that I was a limited government libertarian conservative, and they wondered if that meant that, you know, when I closed my office door, I performed various strange rituals that involved chicken entrails or something. And they found out, no, that was just, you know, a down-to-earth, small-town boy doing management. And you communicate your support to them, and I did. And by the end, they went from being skeptical of all this to they sent me off with a great surprise dinner going away, and they presented me with this big, beautiful scrapbook that had a page from each of them with pictures and thoughts and so forth. I really treasured that. So I had the opportunity, and it works when you do those things.
You have about a minute left for follow-up questions, plus or minus.
You can look at your scrapbook.
Oh, I should have brought it. Can I have one thing that puts these last two questions together? You know, the aging, the silver tsunami problem. We face this problem at the controller's office and in state government in general. It's a well-known phenomenon that the boomers are retiring, and what you need is good succession planning. You need to identify career paths for people who will be aging out, and you need to provide good staff management and leadership. You need to sit down with your department heads and say, okay, tentatively, here's a 2 to 3 year outlook for where we're going to need new people, where we have internal promotion opportunities, and where we might be looking for people outside. Thank you.
Great.
Round three, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Okay. Jay, ready for your third question?
Ron, what has been your greatest career disappointment, and what did you learn from it?
I'll be real brutally frank on that. I had 10 great years, a little more than 10 years, as the principal economist, financial and policy analyst, and technical analyst at the Nevada PUC. When I came here, I'd been consulting and had no idea I'd go back through the door into public service, but I saw this great opportunity. I responded to the tombstone in the Reno paper, and it looked like a great thing, and it was for 5 years, even six, seven, or eight. And with the management change at the commission, I ended up at the end of 10 and a half years or so, 10 and three quarters, something like that, being thanked and sent on my way because I was an at-will employee, and we had had this huge turnover in top management, and I really didn't keep in touch with them. I asked for reasons, and of course, I was never given any reason. I had continuous outstanding performance reports that I've still got copies of, and I was looking forward to staying there until I was planning to run for controller. But they said, no, you don't seem to fit in with, what was the implicit message? You don't seem to fit in with current management, so we're going to go a different direction. That was a pretty tough thing to take in a late career thing, especially after, I can tell you, like I said, I had great performance reports. I had become an accomplished and well-known professional. I was teaching this stuff to national audiences, et cetera. So I knew I was doing a good job at my job, but I guess I got away from management and away from internal politics and away from supervisory stuff, and I loved being a subject matter guru over here by myself and not paying attention to the environment. So what I learned from that was, hey, it's great to be a subject matter guru and have all that fun doing that good stuff and not get involved, but you really need to stay involved with the agency.
I appreciate your honesty.
Thank you.
You know,
follow-up questions?
Just a comment. You know, as I said, I think Pat is leaving some big shoes to fill, and obviously I think one of the most important attributes to a county manager is his ability to adapt, you know. And obviously you learn from what you should have done differently, and it's obviously something you'll need in this position. So thank you.
Thank you.
And other follow-up questions? We still have some time. Okay. Round 2 minutes.
Okay.
Nice. Round 3.
Good question.
Our world around us seems to be changing from coast to coast. And folks working within a public environment or a private environment are getting a tremendous amount of pressure on how to interact with one another. And we've had the hashtag MeToo movement. That is basically a wave hitting all shores. And how to get along and how to approach each other within a close working environment and relationship. And it's leading to a lot of issues in an HR department. And I believe that as this world progresses, that's not going to get easier. It's going to get significantly more challenging. And we've had our experience here with it in a small way, but a very important way. And so I'd be interested in your experience in HR and how you approach HR and how you feel about how we're going to approach the workplace environment in the coming years.
Very thoughtful question, very timely. And in fact, I had in some ways more experience than I wanted as a controller. When I took over the job as controller, the senior capital reporter from the press, Jeff Dornan, who had been around for a while, knows a lot of what goes on, he said, you've inherited a good team and a good organization, and your job is not to screw up. And he said, by the way, the only time you'll ever get any news coverage from me or anyone else is if you do screw up. We never got any news coverage. But we did have a good organization, and there's always, even in, you know, among 40-some people in a good organization, surprise, there's somebody who doesn't fit in, turns out to be a bit of a bad apple, et cetera. And it was a kind of a Me Too thing. I had to listen very carefully, work with my lawyer very carefully, and with the managers, and this person brought a Me Too type complaint against a couple of people in the organization. We worked with the state HR department. They did an investigation. They came back and said, in a 76-page report with 272 pages of appendices, after a thorough investigation, they came back and said there was no sexual harassment, there was no hostile work environment, except that created by this person, okay? And working with our lawyers, the Attorney General gives you a Deputy Attorney General assigned to your agency, but also for things like this, they had a specialist in HR. We worked with them and eventually discharged this person. There was an appeal, and there was a final settlement on that just recently. So it's tough. It's very tough. As you point out, things are different than when we were starting in mid-career professionals. The standards are a lot less forgiving. And like you say, you can see it continuing in that direction. I can see it from this. I still maintain a vital interest in education for two reasons. I've always been interested in education. It served me well, too. My time on the Board of Regents, and three, with the awesome daughter, as a junior in high school now and headed for college, I've dealt with education firsthand at all levels. And what we see in education is the snowflake phenomenon. Somebody says, in this morning's paper, a Harvard student says, gee, one of our law professors took on a case for Harvey Weinstein, okay, you know, as his counsel. Well, okay, Harvey Weinstein's a despicable guy, and the Me Too movement was created by him, and he deserves it all. My humble personal opinion, but he also deserves a lawyer. And for the students to say, we're traumatized? Are you kidding me? We're traumatized because a law professor, who we're not even taking classes from, took on that case? I think it's ridiculous. Down at the grade school level, we have the phenomenon where everybody gets a trophy, right, for participation. I think these things are connected. I think as kids are raised in an environment where they're held harmless, they're told you're going to get trigger warnings and that sort of thing, and as they go forward into adult life, they have these expectations that triggers this ever greater demand doesn't allow you to deal with people's weaknesses and foibles on an effective level. So, like I said at the beginning, or earlier on, I think it's appropriate that integrity and such are the first criterion that you use, and I will always maintain that and enforce it rigorously, but at the same time, we've got to find a balance point to make sure that the organization works effectively, especially as things get more demanding.
Are there any real quick follow-up questions to that? Okay, round three, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So,
I think it's your call, your last question, I believe, sir.
Right.
Okay.
And so I'm going to ask the question, but at any moment the siren is going to blow because it'll be noon. And when it does, I'll ask Pat to stop the clock and stop talking for about 30 seconds because otherwise it'll be hard for everybody to hear you or for taking a recording. So my question to you is, how do you deal with people who disagree with you?
Very good question, and let me pull some strings together from other things I've said. When I came in as controller...
So, go ahead. Wait about 30 seconds. I'll stop the clock. Okay.
this happens at every meeting unless they're working on the roof. So.
Great. I'll get used to it real quick.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
When I came in as controller, again, I had done a lot of study of a number of serious issues, one of which was the employee retirement systems and their financial challenges. And I was writing these occasional controller's reports addressing things like K-12, addressing things like state spending, state revenues, et cetera. And I sat down in a all-hands meeting with my staff, and I told them I was going to bring out a controller's paper on the PERS problems, the underfunding problems that threaten them, that threaten the employees and the taxpayers. And at that point, I thought that the real solution for public employee and other, but public employee retirement programs was to move from defined benefits to defined costs. And ultimately, it may come down to that we may have to do that depending on how well we manage expectations and so forth. But when I told them that, some of my more thoughtful and senior people just came unglued. They thought that was the worst idea ever, and they said, you know, we had effectively a bargain. Nobody put it explicitly in writing, but here's the bargain. And I listened to them, and we talked and argued just a little bit on a high plane. I went away, and then I came back and talked to them individually to them more. And then I did some more research on the details. And I concluded that we don't have to go at this point to defined contributions. We can stick with defined benefits. And it was what I told you about bringing that issue to the PERS board and saying, you've got to get you're doing a great job on managing the investments. It's what I tried to get the Board of Regents to do with their endowment. You're doing a fine job on that, but your expectations of what you're going to get out of that are not realistic, and you've got to adjust those expectations. And so in the end, I came back to our people, and it was because I listened to them, because I rethought, because I did more research, that I changed my mind, okay? I think that is what you have to be able to do. You can't dig yourself into a hole and assume that if somebody challenges you, they're obviously wrong. You've got to rethink some of your most basic assumptions every once in a while and do some more research. Does that answer the question?
It is for the most part. I think that, yeah, it does. I'll follow up later.
If you can follow up now, we're in the ball.
Okay. And so I think just to go a little bit deeper into that, so not only do you disagree with this board or a specific member, you know that you're right. You know that we're wrong. What evidence are you going to do to convince us that we're taking the wrong path?
In general terms, I don't expect to believe that I know that I'm right and you all are wrong. But if that happens, being the numbers nerd I am, the evidence nerd that I am, I'll be bringing you the numbers and the evidence, and I'll discuss it in detail with you. And I do this, by the way, with subordinates, too. Okay? It's not just an order. It's here's why, and believe me, if you can show me I'm wrong, I'll happily concede, okay? One of the things I expect to do in this job is be spending pretty much breakfast, lunch, and dinner with somebody almost every day, talking, getting to know the people in the community and the businesses, but also the staff. And I would think, if you all will countenance it, I would be going to lunch or breakfast or something with each of you once a week or so to bring you up to date on what we're doing, keep you timely apprised of everything, and to hear your concerns. So that continuing communication will afford an opportunity to really pursue things in depth. At the end of the day, as I said, this is not a state executive position. This is a chief administrative position, and my duty would be to work with you all so that you formulate policy, that you work together well, and then we take it and go back to the staff and implement it.
Any other pressing follow-up questions? Okay, at this point, Mr. Chairman, it's anticipated that Ron would make a closing statement of a duration of 5 minutes, followed by public comment.
Very good. Okay. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I think there are three things that are the most important things in this job opportunity for me. First of all, when I became controller, and I said, oh, gee, this wonderful opportunity to provide statewide political leadership, I backed up and I said to myself, it's very important, again, taking the word of Jeff Dornan, don't screw up. It's very important to take care of the basics, the nuts and bolts, the daily ministerial functions, and not let them slide because you're out there doing high-profile political things. And I know that, frankly, some of my fellow state executives had a little bit of problem in that regard. So I was focused at the beginning on continuity, and here I will be focused on continuity also. And one of the great things is the opportunity to learn from Pat, work with everybody else, not come in and say, well, I'm coming from the Capitol, and let me tell you how we're going to do it. It's a lot of listening, a lot of meeting with people and studying and understanding the problems. And over time, if there are changes to be made, the information will show up, and I'll know that. But first of all, it's continuity, taking care of the daily functions. You show up for work every day. It's not rocket science or rocket surgery or whatever. Second thing is people skills, which I mentioned, and reaching out to the businesses, the residents, as well as to the staff, getting to know the people, and what it is they expect, and basically bringing county government to them and finding out how we can better serve them in this time of great opportunity and some challenges. And the third thing is essentially the external relationship, and that would include the businesses and the people, but also the legislature. We've got a great team with Bum Hess, with the Walkers, and by the way, I played basketball once with Bum, and I found out how much better he is or was than I. Anyway, we've got a great team, and we can work with the other counties to present an effective front at the legislature to protect our interests. So those are the things that I would expect to do. Like I said, I look forward to working with the three of you, finding out, helping you determine policy and to implement it. I would add one thing. One of the things I think you've done well, is mining done responsibly. Mining's a tough business, but I think despite all that, things are working really well. And so we continue a good relationship with them, continue a good relationship with the people at TRIC. I know blockchain is talking about possibly a 5 to 10,000 home community, and then, of course, we've got 5,000 more of the Painted Rock, possibly. So we have some interesting developments we've got to oversee and manage, work together. And then, of course, we've got this other residual problem that goes with all that, is that the county roads, I mean, sure, there's some dirt roads, et cetera, but the county roads getting from here to TRIC and to the parkway, et cetera, is not quick. And I don't think we're going to build helipads and helicopter all over the place. So we've got to work on the infrastructure, making it available out there, especially if we do have new residential development. Those are the kinds of problems that excite me. And working with the staff, you've got some real good people in Mr. Wierzbicki, Mr. Gallagher, the Nevins, of course, D.D., what's his name?
Denny Dotson?
Huh?
Denny Dotson?
Yes, Denny, the
tourism director.
Tourism director. It's not a Chamber of Commerce thing. And, of course, Mr. Osborne himself seems like a great asset. So I think this is a fantastic opportunity, and I'm excited, and I'm also out of time.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, our plan is to allow for public comment under the usual 3-minute limitation. And also we did, with legal clearance, put on there this is not a chance to, once again, interview the candidate. These are comments. And if comments are made in the form of a question, then they can be properly followed up later on down the road individually or whatever, but this is not a Q&A interview. And then immediately after the last public comment, staff's going to recommend that we take a 5-minute recess.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah. Okay, so with that being said, we'll go ahead and you can go ahead and remain seated there, Mr. Connect, and we'll open up for public comment. And please, any persons who want to make public comment, limit your comments to 3 minutes in the form of comments only and no questions. No one today?
And, okay. And one last housekeeping rule. Each candidate has already been advised, but I want to advise Ron publicly that he and his family are certainly welcome to stay now to listen to the other two interviews. We just wanted the sanctity of the questions preserved. He's answered those questions. He can hear those same questions asked of the other two candidates. And then I'm betting probably more importantly, save for agenda item 10, when there might be some action.
And then I have just one follow-up question, is that I'm going to assume that the 12-page report you presented to the PERS board was never read.
I read it. The essence of your question is, has PERS been all that responsive? And I'd have to say no, which is why I put in a bill draft request as controller to make them more responsive. But look, you keep on pressing these things, and one of these days, we're making small incremental progress. Do that long enough, and you'll get to where you need to be.
Very good. Thank you.
They haven't been really.
Thank you, Ron. Thank you for being here. Okay, we're going to take a 5 to 10 minute recess.
Five.
Huh?
Five.
I truly appreciate it, Ron. I know it's not easy.